You probably didn't go into psychiatry because you're interested in constipation. But it's here, it's potentially fatal, and our medications are causing it. Welcome to the Carlatt Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlatt Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. In this month's report, we covered a new FDA warning about constipation on clozapine. With a fatality rate of 1 in 1,000, this is not just a nuisance side effect. What's going on is that clozapine slows down the bowels, called hypomotility, and when it gets severe, the bowels literally grind to a halt, and that's called a paralytic ileus. Paralytic ileus is one step away from intestinal obstruction, which can quickly progress to bowel ischemia, perforation, sepsis, and death. And it's not just clozapine that causes this. Hypomotility and paralytic ileus can happen on other antipsychotics, particularly the high-potency first-generation antipsychotics, like haloperidol and flufenazine, and other anticholinergic medications like the tricyclic antidepressants. These other medications have a risk of hypomotility and paralytic ileus that is about half that of clozapine's risks. But the paralytic ileus they cause is much less likely to be fatal. In our online edition, we have a basic three-step guide to managing this hypomotile constipation that begins with preventative measures and moves on to first-line therapy with Docusate, that's Colace, and Senna, otherwise known as Ex-Lax or Sennacot. And we recommend that you read that guide to get the most out of this podcast, because here we're going to delve into the second-line therapies to turn to when those basic interventions don't work.
I spoke with Jonathan Meyer about when to use clozapine and how to manage constipation on it. These steps will be useful for patients who have constipation on other psych meds as well, but keep in mind they are advanced steps for patients who haven't responded to the first interventions. Clozapine itself is an advanced step. We are supposed to start it after the failure of two antipsychotics in schizophrenia. But what does that mean? Schizophrenia is not an illness where we expect to see full recovery. Only about 1 in 10 patients return to a decent level of functioning with schizophrenia. So should we be using clozapine in the other 90%? Not at all. I'm about to tell you one of the most important definitions in psychiatry, and it is not in the DSM. Treatment resistance. In mood disorders, treatment resistant means failure to recover on two antidepressants. In schizophrenia, treatment resistant means failure to respond to two antipsychotics. That is a world of difference between recovery and response. In my own practice, I use treatment resistance as a specifier, much like the DSM guides us to say with terms like schizophrenia paranoid type or schizophrenia disorganized type. I'll use schizophrenia treatment resistant type, because this specifier actually tells us what to do with the medication plan.
Dr. Aiken, I think you're talking about the DSM-4 there. In the DSM-5, they drop those specifiers in schizophrenia, because as you did correctly state, they don't tell us much about treatment or prognosis. They kept in catatonia, and they kept and even added to all the specifiers for mood disorders. So anyway, what does this made-up specifier, treatment resistance, tell us about medication?
In depression, treatment resistance means that we need to stop changing antidepressants and move on to augmentation strategies, ECT, TMS, or intensive psychotherapies that focus on behavior change. Antidepressant switching doesn't help much in treatment-resistant depression, but augmentation strategies can. In schizophrenia, treatment resistance means we need to move to clozapine. So once again, treatment resistance in schizophrenia is defined as failure to respond, not recover, but respond, to two antipsychotics, where response means about a 30% or more in improvement. But Dr. Myers, I'd like to start with this question. Is this 30% improvement in positive or in negative symptoms or both?
Yeah, typically what brings people into the category treatment resistant is positive symptoms. We're not real good at treating negative symptoms, and really the focus tends to be on people who have hallucinations, delusions, disorganized speech or behavior.
In schizophrenia, treatment resistance is based on non-response. But how long do you have to wait to see a response with antipsychotics?
Yeah, so this is a great question. When I trained, the party line was, whoa, 6 weeks of a, quote, therapeutic dose, unquote, was an adequate trial. Of course, now we know some people weren't taking the drug, some people metabolize it, you know, differently. So a better way to frame this, and this is based on reanalyses of a lot of clinical trials, is that for a given dose, if you see no meaningful response within the first 2 weeks, this person is unlikely to be a responder at week six, and it's time to do something different. The first thing to do different is make sure they're taking it, okay? Assuming they are taking it, and they're not getting high, and they're not drinking, if they have no dose-limiting adverse effects, the usual rule of thumb is go up on the dose, because that dose in and of itself is unlikely to make this person a responder. Don't leave them on the same dose for weeks and weeks and weeks hoping for late response. It's unlikely to happen. And that's also true for clozapine. You know, there's this old literature about late response with clozapine, but it really ends up not being true. There actually was a dose escalation study of clozapine done about 20 years ago. What they found is once you got to the plasma level where the person responded, that they will respond on average around day 17. Now, there was a range, and there was one person who did go out to day 56, okay? So that's a bit of an outlier, but I think the idea for most antipsychotics is if you see nothing meaningful on a given dose by week two, then this is something which needs to be examined, and most likely, if they're not having adverse effects, the correct answer is to go up on the dose.
So you wait 2 weeks and then raise the dose, as long as you're within the therapeutic dose range?
Exactly.
What about long-acting injectables? Is it the same two-week wait?
Now, long-acting injectables are a little bit different because if you didn't load them properly, you know, and the kinetics are different, so there's some caveats there. But certainly for oral dosing, if you're really seeing something meaningful. By meaningful, I mean, this is something which you can see with your eyes. So there's this literature out there about correlating the gold standard measures for schizophrenia treatment, like the PANSS and the BPRS, which are used for research, which is something that everyone does every day when they see a patient, which is your clinical global impression. And so most people in schizophrenia studies have a CGI around 5, which corresponds to a PANSS in the mid-90s. And so when people get better, you'll see it. And you'll see that this person looks a bit better. And that's all you're looking for. You're saying, wow, over the last 2 weeks, you're the same as you were before, or you're looking a bit better. And if they are looking a bit better, that means their CGI has probably moved down one unit, and that's a reason to let this person roll for another month or so and see how much more you're going to get out of that given dose.
So in theory, you could move a patient across two antipsychotic trials and into clozapine within 2 to 3 months, if they fail both trials. And you can expect to do that in about 30% of patients with schizophrenia, because 30% have treatment resistance. This is not too hard to remember, but we're not doing it right in America. Only 5% of people with schizophrenia take clozapine in the U.S., while in other countries, the rate is more like 25%, which is much more in line with the 30% who have treatment resistance.
That's why we're featuring clozapine in so many of these podcasts. Start using it. Let's change those numbers.
But the hard part is not knowing when to use it. It's knowing how to manage it and all of its side effects. And this year, the FDA added a new one to that list, paralytic ileus. And the fatality rate with paralytic ileus is actually higher than the fatality rate we see from neutropenia on clozapine. So this is a big deal. Dr. Meyer, how common is this paralytic ileus with clozapine?
Yeah, ileus is relatively uncommon. We're talking well under 10%. But when it happens, it can be a big problem. I mean, there's actually people, again, when it was unrecognized decades ago who died from this, those are usually people in state hospitals. But even now, again, people will still have to go in and have surgery and occasionally a resection. But the other thing, even if it doesn't get that severe, is it's a reason why people say, I don't want to take this anymore.
And then what can we do if we have to stop clozapine? I mean, what else works in treatment-resistant schizophrenia?
If you're treatment-resistant, there's virtually nothing else you have to offer them which is going to be effective. That's why you want to try to get on top of this problem as early as possible.
You've been recommending that we talk about constipation from the day we start clozapine, and now the FDA is agreeing with you. What do you tell the patient?
if you're straining, if you need to take a PRN, you know, outpatient or inpatient, that means I haven't done my job well enough, and let's kind of get you going so that's not an issue. Once you talk to people about that and they let you know that it's a problem, then you can treat it. I think the most important thing is do that proactively, let people know you are going to treat it. We have a lot more options now than we used to in the past. And our goal is that you don't have to strain, you go normally like anyone else, and it's not an issue for you.
And what are your first steps for constipation?
The other thing we should do when we start people on clozapine is kind of follow the protocol, which was established in New Zealand and which we use also in the state hospital in California. So right off the bat, everybody gets docosate. It's like a party favor. It's the price of admission. Everybody gets docosate right off the bat.
For our subscribers, you can read that New Zealand protocol in our article online. Dr. Meyer, I noticed you left fiber supplements like Metamucil, psyllium out of the picture.
The things we often will give higher functioning outpatients like psyllium, which is in Metamucil, should be avoided. What happens is in people whose transit time is that slow, that psyllium forms into a fairly hard piece of gel in the colon and actually makes the problem worse. So psyllium should not be used in clozapine-treated patients.
And what do you do when the first-line protocol from New Zealand doesn't work?
Then now we go to the what are called secretagogues, of which we now have four, which is awesome. And so we've published a case of a patient we treated with lubiprostone, which was the first of these agents, which was called Amitiza. There's also now Linzess, which is linaclotide. There's placanotide. And then there's a new one, which just came out in the U.S., called prucalopride. And so our greatest experience is with linaclotide and lubiprostone. The great thing about those agents is that you put somebody, for example, on linaclotide, and it often works so well, you can get rid of a lot of the other stuff. And so they end up maybe on linaclotide or placanotide and the docosate. But the important thing is use those agents. They cost maybe about $400 a month. You know, most of the time these people get Medicaid or other type of funding anyhow. But it will allow you to keep them on clozapine, which is a win for everybody. Plus, it will avoid them having a really severe GI complication.
Thank you, Dr. Meyer.
Jonathan Meyer is a clinical professor of psychiatry at University of California, San Diego, and the co-author of the Clozapine Handbook. And now for the word of the day, noesis. N-O-E-S-I-S.
Noesis is the belief that one has a divine calling. It can occur in manic, psychotic, or dissociative states. People with noesis have an intense experience of divine revelation where they've been chosen to lead or command others. Noesis can also be a part of normal mystical experiences. In the early 80s, psychiatrist Peter Buckley compared noesis in mystical writings to that seen in schizophrenia, and he concluded that the two differed in an important way. Mystics lacked the disruption of thought so often seen in acute psychosis.
Join us every Wednesday and Saturday for 60 Second Psych, and next Monday for a full-length edition of Research Theme Park, where we take a ride through the food-mood connection, including a new clinical trial of blueberries in depression. Get the full constipation protocol online at thecarlattreport.com, where our podcast listeners will receive $30 off your first year subscription with the promo code PODCAST.
The Carlatt Report is one of few CME publications that depends entirely on subscriber support. So thank you for helping us stay free from industry influence.